You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 29th of June 2016 on Monocle 24. This is Midori House coming to you live from Studio One in London. Coming up.
Certainly, one issue is clear from our debate. Leaders are absolutely determined to remain united and work closely together as 27.
European Council President Donald Tusk after today's summit in Brussels, which for the first time did not include Britain. Also ahead.
The EU is fundamentally a very good idea. It's a free zone, it's a free trade zone structure which we need an awful lot of.
Former US Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan. As Angela Merkel moves to protect the EU's future, we'll look at what that future might look like. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Isabel Hilton, editor of China Dialogue, and Zenya Wickett, head of the US and Americas programme at Chatham House. Welcome both to the programme. All the leaders of the European Union's nations were in Brussels today for talks that for the first time did not include the United Kingdom. Speaking shortly after the discussions, European Council President Donald Tusk reiterated the commitment of the 27 nations to ensure the Union remained united and cohesive. After brushing aside predictions that Britain may try to use the Brexit vote as a bargaining chip for a better deal, German Chancellor Angela Merkel instead focused on the future of the European Union. Well, let's start with Isabel. Your view. You know, this is kind of what we'd expect at this point, isn't it? You know, Europe has to say we're uniting, we're sticking with the project. Next, we'll think about Britain. But at the moment, you know, we are focusing on ourselves and we are going to pull through this.
Absolutely. And that's what any European politician would do. And what's interesting, I think, is that you can see their respective interests emerging. So Merkel with Germany, you know, Britain's a big trade partner of Germany, and Merkel has always been sympathetic to Germany, more so to Britain, more so than the traditional Franco-German axis in the EU. So, you know, she's the voice of moderation. Meanwhile, you've got Hollande, a deeply unpopular president, facing an enormous challenge from both the centre-right and the far-right in France, and with a more Eurosceptic population, according to the polls, than the Brits are. So he's coming out with a very hard line. You've got to go quickly, enough. But I don't think anyone really expects anything to happen quickly. And certainly the British are in no position to make anything happen quickly.
Zenya, do you agree that the Brits can't do anything? We don't have a prime minister. We have a prime minister, but we don't have a new prime minister. We have a prime minister who is, you know,
leaving,
you know, and, you know, seems to, you know, be in kind of like demob happy slightly mood when he was yesterday in Brussels. But so he can't do anything. The government really can't do anything. They don't want to negotiate on this until there is a new PM. The opposition are in chaos. So Britain is in an absolutely rudderless, you know, few months.
I'm not sure I'd go quite that far, but yes, effectively. Quite rightly, I think Cameron said, look, I was standing up for the other side. I clearly can't, you know, guide the country through this. Time to go. And again, quite rightly said, it's up to the next administration to actually figure out how to do this, and they're the ones who should invoke Article 50. So, I mean, he did the right thing. So we do have a bit of breathing space. But he also, you know, gave an opportunity because, frankly, the Leave crowd don't have a clue what to do either. So none of them really anticipated being here. So Boris Johnson, who arguably, you know, putting aside Nigel Farage for a second, Boris Johnson was the head of the Leave crowd. He clearly doesn't have a clue because, you know, you listen to his rhetoric, you listen, you know, read what he writes, and he's all over the place, excepting for backtracking on you know, some of the ostensible pledges that he made through the process. So I think what Britain is quite rightly doing, in a sense, whether they're doing it actively, intentionally, or whether they're being forced to by events, is to essentially say, OK, let's just stop and breathe. for a little while. Let's figure out how we move forward, and then we'll come up with a plan, and hopefully we'll move forward. At least that's the theory. Whether the practice plays out that way, I am somewhat of a skeptic.
Isabel, the extraordinary thing is, obviously, you know, Cameron isn't in a position to soothe the market or to give any hint of direction. But not only is there kind of, you know, skepticism, concern, you know, fear in the markets, but there is no hint at where we're going. You know, are they going to invoke Article 50? Are they going to try and be part of, you know, the trading zone? Are they going to go by world trade laws? There's no, and that is the kind of the sin, almost, you know, that from Boris and Gove, there is not one murmur of what we might see.
They have behaved with absolutely shocking irresponsibility. And I agree, I don't think they expected to win. But, you know, this isn't a game. This is, you know, this is very, very serious for people. But the thing about the Brexit campaign, and it was evident while it was happening, was that everyone was being, you know, all these bad stories were being told, all these lies and false promises were being delivered. But it was never defined what leaving the EU meant, or at least leaving the EU in favour of what was never defined. And now we've had the vote. What we have to do now is define, OK, leave the EU in favour of Norway or North Korea. That's the range of options. So Norway is being part of the European Economic Area, which means paying rather more into EU coffers than we do now, because we would lose Thatcher's rebate. We would lose any influence, but we would retain access to the single market. North Korea.
But the gains from there is.
There are no gains.
Well, there is some control over. I guess they would say they were winning because, you know, you have, you know, you don't have to pay social security people. You don't have to give people the vote.
You do have to let them in.
Absolutely, it's free movement. Free movement comes with it. Any access to the single market involves free movement. So you know, that's the least worst option from my perspective. Well, the least worst option is that nothing happens. But then the next option is the Norwegian option. But it goes all the way to North Korea, which is, you know, you saw yourself off and float off this rump of the United Kingdom, because then there really would be, you know, no Scotland, no Northern Ireland, probably.
There is a. If you want to see, not glass half full, that's going too far, but if you want to see some good come out of this, here's what I would say it is. The big challenge that we face now, that both the Leavers and the Remainers face, is that their supporters are hugely diverse. As Isabel says, you've got some people who want Little England, who want to close down the borders and just be England and we can stand alone, or
England,
Great Britain.
England of the 1950s.
Exactly. You know, or maybe Great Britain, but probably England, and stand alone. And then you've got other people who see the EU as constraining Great Britain, and therefore the loss of the EU means you can have a greater, better, bigger Britain that is more inclusive, that trades more with everybody, not just the EU. And so you've got people within the Leave campaign who have wildly different views. You have people within the Remain campaign who also have wildly different views about why one should remain. And they represent actually the same kind of phenomena that you're seeing in the United States today, a kind of disenfranchised, which is a significant minority / majority, the disenfranchised, and those who have benefited through globalization, through engagement, through internationalization, et cetera, et cetera. And if you wanted to see, as I say, not glass half full, but if you wanted to see a positive, it is that is blatantly apparent. We can no longer pretend it isn't happening. And therefore, actually, can we grasp that? Can our politicians grasp that and do something about the fact that there's huge divisions in society today? And that the reason we are where we are is because of those huge divisions. And so if you want to see, if you had a politician here in the United Kingdom who could grasp that and do something about it, and frankly, I don't know what the policy is that allows us to do something about it, but spend some time thinking about it, that would be a positive over the long term for the UK. Shame that we've had to take this step in order to do that, but nevertheless. The same goes for Europe. If you wanted to see a positive, that those same divisions exist in Germany, they exist in France, they exist in Poland, they exist in Greece and in Italy. Hopefully, one can but hope that this is a wake-up call to them to say, wait a sec, we also have these huge divisions, and maybe we need to do something about that. And so I'd like to say that something good can come from this. Unfortunately, I don't hear that debate. I don't hear the politicians talk about how do we actually get into the fundamental. We've been blaming the EU for all of our faults, and perhaps we shouldn't. Gideon Rackman wrote a great piece in the FT a couple of days ago that essentially said, can we do something about this? Stop blaming the EU for our faults. We're going to have to accept now that it's us.
And he's also written a good piece saying he doubts whether Brexit can really happen. I was just going to say on this issue of, so we understand that, and it has been a wake-up call for, and I think people in London and Bristol and Manchester have been concerned about protesting in a way because they've been castigated as, the liberal educated elite who have lost contact with what's happening in the likes of a Newcastle or the Northeast. But it's a more complicated story than that, and everyone has their right to an opinion. But the strange thing is, when you look at what all the politicians are saying, Labour doesn't have a very confident message for people. Certainly on the Farageian side, in the past it used to be, we need to find a route for you out of poverty via, employment, via opportunity. But, the Farageian version of it is, don't worry, it's not your fault you're unemployed. It's the fault of these people in Europe. And the Conservatives edged into that as well. It's a very, it's pulled people apart in a way that, you can't see how this divide can be healed.
No, but we do need, again, if you're looking at this from a positive perspective, you would say no one is offering a solution to the issues that Gina has outlined. We need a new radical politics. They could be green politics. They could be, community empowerment of all kinds. They could be, there are all sorts of things that you can see which would give work, for instance, to, the angry white men, the disenfranchised, ex-manual workers. There are lots of things that you could see as policies that would address the problems for which people have blamed the EU. Right now, the reality of our situation is we don't know what to do and we don't know who's going to do it. Now, that's going to take quite a lot of time to define itself because all these problems are interlocking. So let us assume that both major parties get new leaders. They've then got to take up this toxic burden, and they're not going to be able to act without Parliament. Actually, it's not up to the Prime Minister to invoke Article 30. Parliament would have to, because Parliament is sovereign, Parliament would have to give him or her permission to do that. And at every step, you have a Parliament which is as appalled in its majority as I think we are at the outcome, and that is going to see its task as defending the best interests of Britain. So that is going to involve trying to maintain access, trying to maintain all the good things. And that is going to lead us, I think, either to just kicking the can down the road or to the Norwegian option. I don't see any other way out.
But just before I bring Zenia back in, the only strange thing about you saying that there needs to be a new radical politics, we've heard that so much. In a way, we do have the new radical politics already. We've got Mr. Corbyn and we've got Mr. Farage. We have moved to...
We have radical politics of the right, but we haven't had a politics of the left.
Well, we've had Mr. Corbyn and it just hasn't...
Mr. Corbyn seems to me to be a politics-free zone. He was almost silent throughout this political crisis. He's in a bunker. He's a dead man walking. Forget Mr. Corbyn.
But he won't go.
He will go. I really don't think that Mr. Corbyn is going to be with us very much longer. Mr. Corbyn's support was an expression of the need and the hunger for a new politics. It wasn't a result.
Zenia, again, the question is, I keep coming back to the notion, which it kind of frustrates me a little bit, because, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, the hunt was for Middle England. Where is Middle England? If we get Middle England's votes, then we can win an election. And now, really, Middle England has been trampled in this vote. It was about ignore Middle England. They've got a house, they've got education, they've got money. It's the fringes that we need to kind of get excited. And I I think that you do need a centrist politics. You do need a consensus. You do need somebody. You know, in the old days, the Labour Party was very good at having, you know, MPs who could answer the needs of people in mining industrial communities and also answer the needs of people in Hampstead. And it could hold that all in one house.
So I disagree with you, Andrew. I don't think this was about reaching out and engaging the fringes. I think this was, there's a book that an American whose name escapes me right now wrote called Bowling Alone that came out about 15 or so years ago. And it basically in part talked about the fact that people aren't engaged anymore in politics. People aren't engaged in society. Middle England wasn't engaged. You know, people were trying to energize Middle England. They were trying to get voters out and they failed dismally. And in part, the Labour Party failed dismally because Jeremy Corbyn didn't care, you know, didn't believe in this and so wasn't willing to go out and try and do it. And the Conservative Party, excuse me, as a whole couldn't do it because it wasn't unitary. And so actually what happened is it wasn't a question of trying to appeal to the margins. It was a question of trying to appeal to the middle, and the middle failed to come out and the margins came out despite it. So I see it as slightly different. I do see, however, I mean, the problem is you're right. You know, we're calling for a radical new politics. I wouldn't use the word radical. We are calling for a politics of collaboration and cooperation, I would argue. We need to actually have both sides of the political spectrum, all sides of the political spectrum, actually come together and work together on a solution that appeals to the broadest needs, as perhaps we used to do, but we have lost in the last decade. And we haven't just lost it here in the United Kingdom. We're seeing exactly the same phenomena play out in the United States with Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump. You know, we're seeing the same phenomena play out in France with Marine Le Pen. We're not alone in this. The question is, can we come up with, and it's extraordinarily hard, but can we come up with policies that actually are able to balance the needs of the broader population? And at the moment, we clearly haven't been doing that.
Well, partly because we have two major parties in this country that came together as coalitions of interest perhaps 90 years ago. And those interests are no longer there. Yeah. You know, the social basis of the Labour Party is no longer there. And actually, neither is the Tories. So these are also husks of institutions that simply don't function. And we have an electoral system that keeps these zombies walking. And I think that, you know, this crisis, if something positive is to come out of it, may finally break that system because they're not working.
It's really interesting you say that, because I spend most of my time looking at the United States, and when I talk to American friends and colleagues, one of the questions that many people are asking are, is the Democratic Party as we traditionally know it, kind of light on security, relatively speaking, inclusive, and the Republican Party, hawkish, kind of energized and internationalized? Are those, you know, but free trade and mercantilist, are those definitions any more valid? And the answer is, most likely after this election, they're not.
Well, they're not the Republican if you look Party, at the polling of opinions, exactly. those don't match up to what we think
to
of
what
those
we're
parties.
Seeing. And yeah. You, that's why you've got a Trump and a Bernie Sanders who, to some extent, are appealing across these party lines. Maybe the same thing is happening in the UK, and that we are going to, until we completely rejigger the politics and the parties and the labels, we're going to be struggling.
The other thing that this is about English identity. When the Labour Party collapsed in Scotland, there was a form of nationalism ready to pick up those votes, which was social democratic, inclusive, not racist. So, you know, as nationalisms go, it's a pretty benign nationalism. English nationalism has not found any kind of liberal voice. It is the ugly nationalism that we all turn away from, you know, the St. George's flag waving bother boys, who have flocked around Farage and who have flocked around various unpleasant causes in the past. And there is a crisis of English identity, which is looking again for a more positive leadership than anyone has offered it. And I think the Tories, you know, this was Tory territory in many ways, they're at a loss also over this. And that's not going to go away until another solution presents itself.
So just a few quick things before we bring in Alan Greenspan, because we want to get the American perspective here as well. Just a few quick things. So the Tories are known as the party of business. You know, they're made up by people who have made their money from business. Why have they allowed themselves to get into a position where they are absolutely destroying British business? And do you think that in the end it's a mistake and they are going to react in a bit of panic and be, because these are the people who pay into the Conservative coffers?
It was a horrible series of grubby miscalculations. You know, Cameron has miscalculated on Europe since the beginning. He brought the Tories out of the Christian Democrat coalition in Europe right at the beginning in order to appease the anti-European members of his party in order to become leader. And he's gone on playing that game. This was a massive miscalculation. He thought he'd win. And of course, as we go down the road of trying to enact this folly, of course business is going to kind of, you know, dig its heels in and fight every inch of the way. And so will the Tory MPs. This is my great hope. Every sensible interest is going to resist.
We've seen EasyJet today, one of the big low-cost carriers, saying, you know, it may not be possible for us to have our base in the UK anymore. We need a European licence. We will look at moving. We've seen Vodafone saying, we can't be here. 11% of our profits come from the UK. It's probably best that we move to Europe. Those conversations going on. People don't wait around in business.
Absolutely.
They're nimble and they're mobile, unlike politicians. And
the 20% of the party's donations last election came from the City of London, which is going to be devastating. If this vote, you know, if Brexit happens, the City of London is going to be in bad shape.
I spoke to somebody yesterday who works for a very big American company from the kind of Silicon Valley world. And she said to me, the really interesting thing is, you know, that we have thousands of staff here in London. But she said, because of the nature of London, it's so damn expensive to buy an apartment. She said, they're all rented places. She said, I bet you I could get half of them out in 8 weeks.
Yeah. No, exactly. I mean, what's interesting is and again, I'm going to go back to the United States. That's what's happening to the Republican Party. I mean, Trump's out there saying things that are anathema to big business. And this is despite the fact that that's where he gets, or that's where the party gets their money. And that's why I say, you know, I wonder whether in the next 3 months, 6 months, year, we will see both here in the UK and in the United States, at least, massive kind of relocations of how the parties define themselves, because the traditional definitions no longer work. They no longer are valid for today's world.
And the coalition doesn't work. If you look at the Tory party leadership election, it's going to be, there are going to be two candidates selected by the parliamentary party, and then the Tory party activists, 100,000 of them, will choose between them, which is absurd, because the interests of the activist, as we've seen, and the interests of the parliamentary party don't appear to coincide anymore.
Well, with both parliaments. Yeah, both
so you've got the parliamentary party trying to coalesce around the sensible candidate, Theresa May, who was not a Brexiteer, in order to stop Boris. And that's going to be a very interesting fight, because that's where the interests are going to come in.
And if she comes in, potentially there is a way of her negotiating, because it isn't her deal, and she was, you know, she
Absolutely.
I must bring in Alan in a second, but just quickly, you know, we saw a small demonstration here in London with, you know, people rushing into the back of Channel 4 were broadcasting. I see there is another kind of demonstration planned for the weekend here in London. Are nice liberal Londoners taking to the streets? You know, and I'm ambitious that, you know, we need to express the opposite opinion as what's happened. But does that help? Because is that just going to be like the Daily Mail saying, oh, here we go, kind of like posh kids out on the street demonstrating, they have no idea about what's going on? Can liberals, you know, liberals with a small L, can the centre demonstrate against this?
Well, look, it was nearly half the people who voted the other way. You know, this business about the people who have spoken, that it wasn't like it was a massive victory. And the people have spoken. They've spoken in tongues. Nobody knows what they've said. You know, and that's the problem. So I absolutely think that those who voted to remain have a right to make their voices heard.
Zenia, is it time to fight?
Quickly, I think they have a right to. I don't think it's going to make any difference whatsoever. In the end, it was a democratic process. You know, it was dirty, but so is democracy and so is politics. And we have to accept that. And in the end, the leavers won. And I don't I don't personally see a, I hope you're right, but I don't see a way in a democratic system of we can mitigate it all we want, but I don't think we can reverse it.
Look, we have reversed referenda all over Europe many times.
Yes, we have.
You know, this is advisory. There is nothing, there is no constitutional mandate here. This is all politics. And the one thing you can be sure of is that the politics are going to change.
Yep.
Can I just ask you, Zane, we should have played the clip, but we've had too much fun in here. Kerry yesterday was very clear. You know, he it's a shame that Britain didn't stay. You know, we like the British voice in the EU. You know, we now have, you know, Alan Greenspan saying, you know, it's a shame. Actually, the EU is a good thing. That, again, is going to be uncomfortable for the Tories, isn't it? That feeling that, you know, yes, of course, America will say we're special friends, you know, for the press release. But actually, in the background, they're not happy about it either.
If you assume that this goes through, let's just make an assumption that this happens, that we come up with a Norway deal or something like that, but Britain is out, Britain or England, depending on how that plays out. We just have to assume that over the, not quickly, not immediately, but over the next 10 to 20 years, yes, America will have a special relationship with the United Kingdom. It will also have a special relationship with Germany and France and Poland. And we should just assume that we will be one of many. We will, and there'll be something about the Anglo-Saxon values or history that will resonate emotionally, but in policy terms, in practical terms, in reality terms, our relationship will be no more special than it is with many other countries. That is the direction we're going. This vote will only have sped that phenomena, that results along.
Isabel, again, you, even if they don't listen to kind of nice liberals on the streets of London, do you think there is a sense that, you know, in the end, you know, does Boris Johnson, does Michael Gove want their legacy to be that they broke up the union, that they forced a united Ireland, that they lost the special friendship of America, that they destroyed business? Surely there must be someone out there thinking, we need to ameliorate this position.
One would hope so. I mean, they've been in hiding since Friday when they looked, their last public appearance on Friday morning, they looked as though they were at a funeral. They did not look like people who just won a victory. And I think they are very worried.
So ameliorate, yes. I think everybody on both sides in the political scene, maybe not in the public, but on the political scene, is trying to ameliorate, mitigate the repercussions of this. But something has happened. I think we have to do two things. One, we have to recognise why it happened and try and answer that. And at the moment, nobody's even looking at that. And then we do need to take steps to say, as with all things, this is going to have some really negative consequences. And how can we mitigate, ameliorate those negative consequences? We will get there. People will start doing that. Unfortunately, as Isabel says, everybody is so stunned that that nobody's doing it yet. But hopefully that will change.
And Isabel, just quickly, you know, even if there is some movement away from it, some movement to a more centre, you know, a more consensus opinion, you know, we've now provoked 4 million Farageian supporters, UKIP, who were angry and, you know, and are out on the street saying things that we don't like. But also on the left, we've provoked a lot of people to be really het up about the EU and really het up about what's happening in the cities that they feel they're disconnected from. That is, for both sides of the political spectrum, there are going to be some very angry people, whatever happens now.
There are going to be very angry people. And my biggest worry about all this is when those 4 million Farage supporters find out that they were lied to as well, that actually no one can deliver what Farage promises. It's just nonsense. Who are they going to turn on? You know, because we've seen these rumblings of unpleasantness. We've seen, you know, small but worrying attacks. These are people who have been made angry, and we've seen this coarsening of public discourse. Farage has given a license to people to be racist, actually. And I think that is probably the most worrying part of it, that violent element, that the idea that Farage could stand up and say, without a shot being fired, we've won, you know, a week after the murder of a Labour MP, I really worry.
Well, these are fast-moving events, and we'll be covering them over the coming days as we see a new leader for the Labour Party and the nominations announced in the next couple of days for the Conservative Party to be their new leader and, of course, Prime Minister. But for now, that's all we have time for. Isabel and Xenia, thank you very much for joining us. Today's show was produced by Ben Ryland. It was researched by Gaia Lutz and by Patrick Hahn. And our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. There's more music next. Then at 1900 Hours, it's The Entrepreneurs with Daniel Giacopelli. We'll have more on the day's main stories on the Monocle Daily at 2200 hours. Midori House is back at the same time tomorrow. But from me, Andrew Tuck, thank you for listening and goodbye.